This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face-to-face with business decisions. Online at www.bgov.com. And of course, on the air right here on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We've got Exhibit 300s on BGov. Bloomberg Government has them, and there's lots of money out there to be made in the cloud these days. It's actually not going anywhere, as I kind of anticipated. I'm a horrible speculative person. I thought this cloud was just a fad, but we've got Exhibit 300s out there for cloud computing opportunities. The man to tell us all about them, the senior technology and telecommunications analyst, Mr. Afzal Bari, and he's here right now. Hey, how are you?
Doing well. How are you?
So this cloud isn't going anywhere, is it?
No. Yeah, it's not.
All right, I guess I should just embrace it. And there are a lot of agencies out there who are actually saying to themselves, we need to spend more money to invest in this. DISA, most recently, just within the past couple of months, I believe it was, actually said, we're going to start spending money in the cloud. And you've got proof here that they're doing just that.
Yeah, and they have two large $400 million plus opportunities out there for cloud computing. And it's one of those things. So your initial question, it's not going anywhere. So
I was just joking.
Well, 2 or 3 years ago, that was a legitimate question, right? Yeah. I mean, so two or three years ago, there was a question out there in the marketplace. Okay, is this cloud thing, is this just a fad? Is just this just coming out of OMB? Are agencies really going to embrace this, right?
Well, and it's funny because I guess it was 2 or 3 years ago when Apple released their cloud. And that's the point when you go, all right, this is real.
Yeah.
If Apple's jumped on this, it's a real thing.
Yeah.
But OMB, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I mean, so that's a fair point. So consumerization of technology kind of influences the way people think about technology that they use within the enterprise. But 2 or 3 years ago within government agencies, there was a big question of, are agencies actually going to embrace this? Are they going to worry about security? Are they going to worry about losing control? Things like that. And now the cloud computing opportunities are out there. There are cloud computing opportunities. They've mentioned them in the Exhibit 300s. We've dived into the data and taken a look at that.
Infrastructure as a Service, IaaS is what it's being called. And CIA was awarded a gigantic contract as well. Oh. That with Amazon?
So that was somewhat controversial, and that was a little while ago. So CIA awarded a contract to Amazon that was, and we only found out about it after the fact when IBM protested the contract award, and it was the GAO protest was something that was widely publicized, that's up on BGov, and that we looked at.
So let's talk about this federal cloud market activity. You've got three different notations here: IaaS, SaaS, and PaaS. Please, definitions.
Lots
of acronyms here. No idea what they are.
Okay, sure. So let's put it back into that consumer technology bucket, right? So infrastructure as a service tends to be things like storage, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about Dropbox, if you're talking about Google Drive, so being able to store information out on the cloud, not necessarily on your hard disk. So that's typically one of the main components. There's some other components. I'm simplifying.
Sure.
Software as a service is being able to run whatever application you have on the cloud rather than on your desktop. So Gmail is a good example of something that's software, or Google applications. They've got several applications.
Adobe has done wonders with that as well.
Adobe
putting everything
in
the cloud.
Yeah. And so you no longer have to run these applications on your desktop. Instead, you're running them on servers on the cloud, and that's where the tough processing power is being used. And then platform as a service is a little bit trickier to explain. Probably a good example is something like Facebook is a platform that has lots of different companies can actually build on top of that platform, build their own applications on top of that platform. And so being able to do this, something similar within the enterprise.
So let's take a look at this holistically, major IT investments with cloud plans. As we take a look at the agencies who are poised to spend some money here, who are the leaders? Who are the ones who are really jumping into the fray and saying, yep, we see this as something that's going to happen and we need to spend some money on it?
Yeah, sure. So, well, let me just step back. This is and explain what we did. So,
we
looked at the Exhibit 300s, which are any major IT investment, any investment of a significant size within an agency. They have to, you know, give this plan every year, right? And we looked at, and this year is the first year where they checked a box saying cloud computing, yes or no, right? Does this include cloud computing either currently or planned? So we actually looked at all of the Exhibit 300s and looked within across the agencies, what percentage of them are they checking the box for cloud computing? And then dug in a little bit deeper to see whether or not the description actually says anything about cloud computing, whether they've given any evidence, even if they check the box,
have they
actually done it? So Social Security Administration actually, so out of all their major investments, 100% of them, they've checked the box saying, yes, we will have some form of cloud computing in that. Now, at the same time, only 25% of them mentioned some sort of cloud-related technology. 75% didn't really mention the cloud technology as much. So there's a question of whether or not they're there yet. But Social Security is definitely one of those. Department of Labor also 53% of the projects that they've outlined. They've said will actually have some sort of cloud computing technology in them.
Is there a conscious effort to maintain the level of security they had with the information contained in-house, like in a data warehouse somewhere?
There are a couple of things when it comes to security within the cloud, mm-hmm. right? So part of it is a loss of control, so you might not necessarily have 100% control over all the data. At the same time, you have to think that some of the data that's sitting out there in a very disparate fashion on servers that are underutilized, that they might not have the best resources guarding them. So the example I give is when it comes to banks, you know, I can have $10,000 in my mattress and I have 100% control. Is that more secure or less secure than having it in a bank and trusting a bank with that money?
Sure.
Where it's still they're holding it for me. But
I got the money in the mattress all day.
Yeah, so I mean, it's, and that's it's very similar. It's if you have all these servers all around the place, well, each of them might not be as secure as having them in a few repositories and really putting up really big fences around those.
Let's talk a little bit about FedRAMP.
Years ago, before FedRAMP, the way that if you were a cloud provider, the way that you would actually get an authority to operate, you have to get this authority to operate within a particular agency, is you'd get that by each agency. So if you're doing work for Homeland Security and you're doing work for DHHS, you'd have to get separate authorities to operate for each of those. And each of them would have some different controls, security controls that they wanted. Each of them would have different audits that they wanted. So you might have duplicative work for the same systems, right? So it might be the same cloud systems that are serving both, but you'd have duplicate work.
Mm-hmm.
And FedRAMP was an initiative by GSA to be able to try to streamline that, to say, look, we're going to create a baseline security control that can apply across all of the agencies that's signed off by DHS, DOD, and whichever agency is first for that vendor. And we're going to have that baseline control. And then if you're going to go layer on some additional requirements as like another agency, then you only test for those additional requirements. You're reducing the amount of free work. Now, it's actually ended up becoming pretty difficult for some of the vendors to get their authority to operate under FedRAMP, right? So one of the things that we found is only, I think it's seven of the vendors have actually gotten authorities to operate. FedRAMP's only been around for about a year and a half. So, but I think within the marketplace, vendors might have underestimated how difficult it is to get the authority to operate and how this is, GSA isn't really treating this as a check the box exercise. Yeah, so.
What kind of exercise is that? That's kind of funny. You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're speaking with Afzal Bari. He's a senior technology and telecommunications analyst with Bloomberg Government, who's now examining Exhibit 300s for cloud computing opportunities. And as we look down the rabbit hole, what's next for this? What else can we expect to find on the horizon?
On the FedRAMP front, I think there's a deadline of June 2014 when all projects, even older projects, where the vendors need to be FedRAMP approved. One of the things that you can see on the horizon is you know, you can guess either a lot more vendors have to get approved between now and June of next year, or which may happen, but it's not 100% likely. Or they're going to have to let that deadline slip or give some exceptions for vendors that are already there. I have a hard time believing that if a vendor has been doing work for an agency for a number of years with cloud computing and they don't have the FedRAMP ATO come June 2014, that GSA will have any sort of authority to be able to say, no, you can't do business with them starting in July, right? I mean, I think they'll have to grant some exceptions. At the same time, I think vendors are taking this seriously and are really trying to get those authorities to operate.
Thanks, Afzal. I appreciate it.
Sure, anytime.
It's called Examining Exhibit 300s for Cloud Computing Opportunities. His name is Afzal Bari, and this is Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. My next guest is one who admittedly geeks out on energy. His name is Rob Barnett. He's an energy analyst, senior energy analyst with Bloomberg Government. He's put together what would you call this?
It's a narrative about what's going on in a small niche piece of the energy world.
The Energy Independence and Security Act, signed by President Bush back in 2007, was kind of intended to move the United States onto a more energy independent footing, so to speak. That coupled with the increase in production of clean, renewable fuels were just a couple of things of the intended result of this act. Unfortunately, we're now about 6 years later and we haven't quite hit the mark. Is that an accurate statement?
Well, it depends on how you judge the success of the program.
Okay.
But one of the things that the act tried to do was increase the market for renewable transportation fuels. So we have this thing called the Renewable Fuel Standard, or the RFS, as folks in the business call it. And that says you've got to blend a certain amount of ethanol or biodiesel into the transportation fuels we use in the United States. And the policy has been really effective at bringing some of those fuels into use. But at this point, we're kind of hitting the upper limits of maybe what those fuels can do. And sort of absent some changes, we'll probably not are going to have more challenges meeting the sort of goal of the policy going forward.
So some of those changes, I would imagine, would involve the automobile industry having to do something to manufacture an engine that can handle this now highly blended fuel, which leads me to this blend wall. Explain, please.
Right. So in the business, we have this concept that we call the ethanol blend wall. So when folks fill up their cars at gas stations across the U.S., you know, you think you're buying gasoline, and you are for the most part, but you're actually buying a blend that contains about 90% petroleum-based gasoline, the traditional stuff we would have called gasoline, and about 10% of it is ethanol right now in the United States. But there's a lot of hurdles to going beyond that 10% ethanol blend for most cars and trucks. Now, you've probably heard about E85
sure.
or flex fuel vehicles.
Sure.
So there are some cars out there that can handle higher ethanol blends. But for your typical car, at least right now in the United States, most auto manufacturers don't want to guarantee and warranty the engine for it using fuel above the 10% level.
Is this a lot of money at stake? Are people lobbying this for and against the changes that are necessary to be able to break this wall, so to speak?
Right. You know, there are folks on both sides of the argument. I think all in, you know, there are countries that use plenty of biofuels. You look down to Brazil, where biofuels are a big part of the mix. They use much higher concentrations of ethanol in their society. But they've got the car and the automobile stock is sort of it's long-standing set up to be able to use those type of fuels. So, you know, over time, you could imagine transitioning. It really is something that can't occur quickly, though, because the auto manufacturers have to prepare for it and
sure.
provide the kind of vehicles. And so basically the conundrum right now is that we're kind of at the maximum amount we can use, but the standard says you need to use more, and the refiners are the ones who are supposed to actually blend the ethanol. And so the auto manufacturer is saying don't use more than 10%, and the refiners are saying, well, we can't meet the standard if we don't use more than 10% ethanol. And so it's going to be really interesting to see who's going to win, how it's going to play out, if Congress will get involved or not.
It's the perfect catch-22. Where are we going with this?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an issue with all kinds of policies and whether they are sort of technology forcing policies or not. And so I think, you know, so far the policy put in place by Congress was one that industry could meet, but the policy keeps going up and up and up, and we've kind of hit that stopping point.
Right.
And the question is, well, can industry innovate to get there? And I think the long-term answer is absolutely. But the short-term answer is probably not. I mean, in the long term, you could have solutions on the automobile side where you harden the engines and make them capable of taking, you know, higher blends of biofuels. Some people might say, well, just why don't we go all the way to E85? Why
not just roll this out? I understand it's a lot more complicated than just me going, hey, let's just do this.
Well, I mean, a huge part of it is how long it takes the automobile stock to roll over.
Sure.
But I mean, the holy grail really, though, is actually on the fuel side of the business, and sort of ethanol and biodiesel are really sort of the primary biofuels that we think of. But it's actually possible, at least in the lab, to do like drop-in fuels, like bioequivalent gasoline that's made from a non-petroleum source, so it's like chemically the same. I mean, that's the holy grail. And then you solve all of these problems, sure, and you don't have the issue. So, you know, there are folks working on that, but with any kind of innovation and breakthrough, you know, you can't predict it. You don't know when it's going to happen. I mean, there are a lot of folks who would like to see these, what we would call like super advanced, you know, advanced biofuels, you know, fourth generation biofuels, third generation biofuels that just aren't on the market. The sort of marquee biofuel is made from corn here in the U.S. It's corn-based ethanol. But finding smarter ways to do the production of biofuels could really be the solution to all this. And, you know, only time's going to tell about how that evolves and how the technologies change there.
Is this something the oil companies have contracted to work on, or are they sticking with the crude coming out of the ground?
I think you'd be surprised that some of the oil companies, especially some of the companies here in the U.S. with large refining operations, mm-hmm, also happen to be some of the largest owners of ethanol production capacity. So they're capable of both making petroleum-based fuels, and they have the biofuels because of this policy to blend in with it. And you know, at the end of the day, we are consuming less petroleum in the United States than we were back in 2005. Oil demand in the U.S. peaked in 2005, and it's a mix of forces as to why we're consuming less. You know, the economy hasn't been as strong, so there's an economic piece there.
Mm-hmm.
We are using more efficient vehicles, so as we buy new cars, we're getting smaller ones, they're getting better miles per gallon. But the biofuel piece has pushed out some of that petroleum as well. So you've got this, you know, three factors that are helping to actually help make the United States more energy independent. Some of them are policy related, like the biofuel piece. Some of it's market related. Oil prices are much higher than they used to be, so folks have responded to that price. And then we've just got some general economic issues that you know, people aren't driving as much as they were prior to the recession, things like that.
On August 15th of 2013, the EPA issued a rule that significantly lowered the biofuel requirement. Underneath this, they've acquiesced at this point, saying, you know what, we're not going to make it.
Well, it's, you know, at the headline level, I think that's right, but there's a lot of nuance to that. And so each year, EPA has issued what's called a waiver for the a portion of this RFS that's out there.
Are they giving up, so to speak? Because they realize it's impossible to do.
Right. And so it's interesting because they have kept the policy on the books.
And that's why I'm saying, are they giving up?
And each year, the policy gets more and more difficult to meet.
Sure.
But then each year, EPA says, "We know you're not there yet," and they sort of say, "We're not going to hold you to the full requirement of the policy." So one piece of the RFS is that they require a certain amount of what's called advanced biofuels, or cellulosic biofuel in particular, which is basically ethanol that's not made from something that we also eat. So don't make it from corn. Figure out how to make it from, you know, leftover plants that we that we're not using in our food supply, and that's the holy grail in some ways.
Poison but we ivy over here,
exactly.
but
we haven't got we just haven't actually seen that come to the market really. We've got some experimental plants that are doing it, but at nowhere near the volumes that Congress wrote into the law. So it really does create a challenging situation for the refiners and folks who have to comply with this rule, because Congress has said thou shalt do X, and X is not available in the market.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Rob Barnett, Senior Energy Analyst with Bloomberg Government. Renewable fuels hit blend wall. Despite EPA's 2013 biofuel revisions, standards may force corporate penalties and higher gas prices next year. Is that a fact? Will prices now, because of what is going on in this biofuel industry, will there be a repercussion on the regular fuel target?
Right. I think there's certainly a risk that prices that folks pay at the pump could go higher as a result of some of the shortcomings of this policy. And specifically, like I was saying, you know, that the policy says you've got to use more and more biofuels, and they have a compliance mechanism for showing that companies are using those biofuels. So it's essentially like a tradable market to say, hey, yeah, I'm using enough biofuels, and if you're using more than you need to and another company is using less than they need to, they could buy some of your excess credits. So there's a currency of the program, so to speak, and the price for those credits has gone up over time, and they could go up significantly higher if some of these big issues don't get resolved. Because at the end of the day, if you're a company, you've got an obligation to show to the federal government to say, hey, we're meeting the letter of the law or the intent of the law that Congress passed, and there's a way that they do that. And if you can't do that, you face the potential for fines and things like that. So if you start seeing company get fined for not being in compliance, you know, ultimately that passes through to the consumer.
So what's next? What do we have to look out for in the future here? 2014, targets aren't going to be met again. What's the next step in this process?
Well, you know, it's really interesting from a political standpoint, because you've got a coalition of bipartisan Congress members that are actually talking about this topic. You've got Henry Waxman and Fred Upton, who probably couldn't be further apart in a sort of political assessment, mm-hmm. but they actually are both concerned about this policy and this issue, and they're having an open dialogue about some of the problems with the program, the perceived problems, and how do you fix them and move forward. So I think there is an effort on sort of bipartisan cooperation in the Congress on this. At the same time, you never know for sure. I mean, I would say chance of any legislation in the current political environment is very, very, very low, mm-hmm. Of making it through the House and Senate. That being said, this is one of the things where you actually have a dialogue on that crosses party lines. So, you know, maybe there's some chance that Congress kind of steps in and provides a solution. If not, the folks that are subject to the policy, the refining companies primarily, they've got to really deal with EPA, and they'll have to really ask EPA again next year to issue a waiver and sort of reduce expectations for what they're supposed to do. But when you're dealing with the regulatory entity like that on a year-on-year basis, you really don't ever have any certainty. And I know for most businesses, you'd like a little bit more certainty about what you've got to do over, say, a 5-year or 10-year horizon, instead of having to deal with this issue year after year after year.
Sure. Willie Nelson, I guess, was onto something, you know, driving a bus filled with corn oil, smelling like French fries, heading down the highway from show to show. Rob Barnett, thank you very much for being here.
Pleasure.
For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.